And on ABC Radio National, Amanda Smith with you with Artworks. The artist Bill Henson is known in this country and internationally for his haunting and moving and beautiful photographs. He's also known for the massive controversy that blew up in 2008. Some of his photographs seized from a gallery in Sydney, the public debate about whether his images of nude and semi-nude teenagers constituted child abuse. In Artworks over these past couple of years, we've heard a range of views about all this. Now we hear from the man himself. Bill Henson delivered the opening address of the Melbourne Art Fair earlier this month, and this is an abridged version of his talk. The only talk, by the way, by an artist that I can recall where there was also a big burly security guard standing on the stage, keeping an eye on the big crowd gathered to hear Bill Henson.
As the new BIS recording of Mozart's K-364 Sinfonia Concertante, the Andante movement only, repeats itself endlessly on my stereo, the sound of Richard Tognetti and the ACO Orchestra at their absolutely greatest washes over me like a tsunami. While my head is also spinning with the staggering beauty of a single gesture made by a woman riding the escalator at the Westfield Doncaster Shopping Centre, and with just how Tognetti's violin sounds like she looked. Well, there you have it. I call it millennial slippage. You might call it madness. But in any case, please explain. I'll do my best. I'm not here today to talk about the downfall of Kevin Rudd or the prospects for some Elizabethan renaissance of the arts if Julia Gillard is elected. I do want to talk about art, though, and the fact that we need a politics that makes the world safe for art. Art itself, of course, can never be entirely safe, either in its origins or as it's experienced, because it's a form of truth, and truth is a wild thing for us to tame. I'm a great enthusiast for the power of blackness in art. I think of Liszt, the man who was dubbed a demon, and the thrill of the diabolism in his music that made the world think that Liszt practiced a dark art. Well, they thought Ovid was a magician, and he ended up in exile. Think of the audacity with which he begins his great metamorphosis, the tale of transformation. My purpose is to tell of bodies which have been changed into shapes of a different kind. All art leading on from Ovid's epic, the trajectory of whose influence would encompass Shakespeare and the great painters of the Renaissance, to this fragment, we feel that sense of millennial slippage, of becoming one with the artistic expression of the past. Art is always a matter of transformation. Oscar Wilde, who believed that you put your genius into your life rather than into your art, created one kind of mythology for this in the picture of Dorian Gray. The man becomes a thing of beauty while the hidden painting becomes the progressive revelation of his evil. And with a wholly different emphasis, shadowed with the spectre of the memory of Nazism, there is Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, where the composer Adrian Leverkuhn achieves greatness in his art but at the cost of a Faustian bargain. I hasten to add that these mighty mythologies are not guides to the personal lives of the artist. You need only read the biographies of Oscar Wilde or Thomas Mann to be disabused of that kind of nonsense. But they do point to the fact that art can seem like a force of nature that is beyond anyone's control and is therefore always potentially disturbing. It's also incidentally related to the fact that the experience of art overtakes reason. Art does not so much stare back at us as stare through us. It can find us wanting, just as it can make us feel whole. Democracy, for heaven's sakes, is there to make the experience of art available potentially for the greatest possible number. The duty of our politicians, when it comes to art, is not to deny the distinctiveness of art, still less to scapegoat and demonise the artist, confusing as the picture may sometimes get, but to make art available to every member of society, regardless of how well off they are or where they went to school. History is littered with the bonfires of the vanities. Savonarola terrorised Renaissance Florence, and even Botticelli was sympathetic to the witch hunters and image burners for a while. Just as some liberal-minded people, keen to protect the innocence of kids, have found themselves on the side of the Puritans and the prohibitors. It seems to me that it's easy to be muddle-headed about this when it comes to questions of harm, consent, and what have you, and to fail to acknowledge that the license of art, its ability to appear transgressive and radically unreasonable, is part of the cloud of unknowing that comes with the territory. It's part of the wonderment of history that Madame Bovary and James Joyce's Ulysses, like Lolita in the 1950s, Portnoy's Complaint in the 1960s, were the subjects of bans. And just in case we think these battles are won forever, Lolita, for reasons that may seem familiar, is once again under fire, not from the censors, but from vigilantes, who recently managed to have it withdrawn from over 1,500 retail outlets across this country. Well, there must have been a complaint. It figures, of course. We spend most of our lives in a world where we go at a green light and stop at a red light. Of course we have to live like this. No one seriously denies that this is how we have to function in society. But it's not how the imagination works, and it's not how art works. Recalling Dostoevsky's The Possessed, that devastating novel about terrorism, whether in the text or as a postscript at the end, any edition will include Stavrogin's confession, the scarifying chapter about the sexual abuse of a young girl. The Possessed is conventionally referred to as the greatest political novel ever written, the supreme prophecy of totalitarianism. We would run a mile from Stavrogin in real life, but it's in the nature of art that we let him into our imagination.
This is Bill Henson speaking earlier this month to a packed house at The Edge in Federation Square in Melbourne, an address he called The Light and the Dark and the Shades of Grey. At about this point in proceedings, the security guard, who'd also been standing on the side of the stage all this time, decided it was okay to sit down at the side for a while. As Bill Henson continues.
One of the great and obvious things about artistic experience is that it abides. Once you've finally got Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you've got it forever. It will abide for you in a world of jingling and jangling, trash and diversion. We have no easy social measurement for the way we are charged by the experience of art, but we know we are changed utterly. And however poor in spirit, or morally down and out, we know that we are the better for it. In fact, that we are immeasurably richer for it. There was once a widespread perception of this, but it seems to be receding, at least as a value that can be publicly invoked, sure of receiving reciprocation from the electorate. Have we really, at least as far as we are represented by our politicians, become a nation which has exchanged the bird's eye view for that of the slug? I trust not. It would be appalling if our politicians were really, as they sometimes seem to be, so frightened of the angry foot of every agitating wowser that they are content to slide along the ground, oblivious of the moral imperatives and the high claims of artistic attainment. There can be times when it's hard not to take this dim view. And there are also the pressures, of course, on everyone in everyday society. In a world where market forces have relativised all sorts of accepted aesthetic standards and have relegated the animation of the imagination, the creation and experience of art, to a low spot on the cultural food chain. Everyone knows that this is a falsification of value, that Hollywood action films designed for boys of nine don't compare well with Brando or Bertolucci at the height of their powers, but we're almost embarrassed to say so. In a world where everything tends to be reduced to a pedestrian wasteland of utilitarian contentment, where everyone spends an inordinate amount of time on cultural popcorn, who can blame the politicians if they're content to see art burn? I think we can. As a friend of mine said to me recently, without the law, we would have no society, but without art, we'd have no civilization. Art is what connects us to history, just as it allows us to feel the ground of our own being as well as the farthest reach of where the imagination can fly. This is a potentially shared heritage, and what makes us who we are, even though we experience different parts of it and do so individually. Recently, when I found myself in that shopping mall and in the midst of the crowd swirling past into the Village Cinema complex like a black hole, I caught sight of two teenagers embracing on the floor, just two kids caught in an embrace in a cavity beneath the escalator. They were inward-looking. They were so intent, so embedded, so uncaring of the world around them. The scene also reminded me of other things, but it was like an Eric Fischel painting. Two contemporary kid tourists in Rome, they were playing under a plinth which supported a sleeping hermaphrodite, Roman copy, the painting entitled The Sheer Weight of History. But the poignancy and the beauty of this scene doesn't depend on the echo. It was the continuity, the life that inheres in art and out of which art comes, which was important. We need art if we are to survive as who we are. In order to be civilized human beings, we need to be able to experience art and, if we can, create it. Is this to ask for a special dispensation, a different law for artists so that they can commit their outrages? Not at all. It's simply to ask people to realize that the moral integrity of art inheres in the structures and pressures that produce it. Instead, we see a new growth in censoriousness and the impulse to constrict the conditions under which art is produced. Absurd attempts to conflate child welfare and artistic freedom as an issue. The idea that the two could be in some way mutually exclusive is absurd. We have bans on depicting the human body, attempts to ban Pasolini's Salo and Lolita and anything that so much as imagines child abuse. Isn't it clear that this way madness lies? Surely the last thing we should bequeath to the young in the name of child welfare is a regime of pandemic fear. So what can we give the young? Well, I suggested to one of my models that he type the following three words into Google: Glenn Gould Bach. Over school, over uni already, let's see you get over this. Let's see how that might enlarge the 18-year-old mind. Or perhaps you might show them Raging Bull. I'd like them to experience this millennial slippage. It might be triggered by the way Maria Callas could peel away the layers of an aria to the naked emotion within. It might be Michelangelo's Academy slaves forever enacting the enigma of whether they are emerging from or disappearing back into the stone. It might be that tragic figure of Jake LaMotta, as played by De Niro in Raging Bull. What we have a moral duty to bequeath to our children is an apprehension of the haunted and spiritually radiant landscape of history, as art has illuminated it and given it truth. Are there implications for any possible politics in this? A politician, it seems to me, should not expect to see the effect of culture. But our politicians should realise that the practice and experience of art, which constitute our culture, are among the most precious things we have. When a kid learns ballet or fumbles with a piano or tries to nut out a Latin poem or learns a passage of Shakespeare, do we no longer take it for granted, perhaps, that these things are the bedrock of our civilisation? In practice, if we cease to honour the ongoing creation of art and the possibility of great achievement, then we will cease to believe in art as anything other than the basket case at the bottom end of the entertainment industry food chain. We'll see the masterpieces and classics that we've been taught to cherish, the supreme works of genius, as merely heritage or museum culture, the way the current federal arts minister appears to see them, exhibiting nothing but a manifest irrelevancy. It's ludicrous that anyone should have to even say that Bach or Shakespeare, Mozart or Michelangelo should be central to what we should transmit to our children. But there it is. If you want to protect children, expose them to this vast backward shadow of art. If you want to preserve the innocence of a child's eye and the imagination of a child that can soar and remember its first epiphanies of beauty forever, then give that child the riches of what civilization has produced. Without the moral truth of art, we have nothing. It's when we throw that away that we fail our children.
You're listening to Artworks on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia, and the Melbourne Art Foundation lecture given by celebrated and controversial artist Bill Henson. As you might imagine, plenty of questions from the audience were forthcoming, and this is a selection of them. Now, you'll also hear at one point the voice of John McDonald, the art critic for the Sydney Morning Herald. He's moderating proceedings.
In terms of your experience as an artist and what you've been through in the last couple of years and the world that we have, is there not perfection and art in what's actually happened around that whole experience in the last 2 years?
Well, look, if you mean has it reinforced whatever conviction I had prior to 2008, it may well have done. So I've continued to work. I didn't stop working or anything, and for better or worse, I continue to do exactly what I've always done. I can say something which isn't related exactly to your question, but that is that there are certain things you have to be very careful of. And in those situations, one of them is not hardening up. You have to remain sensitive to the beauty of the world around you, because if you let yourself toughen up in response to those situations, then your work will probably suffer.
Do you believe that the attitude towards the nude has changed in Australia irrevocably since the incident 2 years ago?
Oh, I don't think that it's changed irrevocably. I think that there has been quite an attempt to, you know, as I said before, conflate this kind of artificial situation where, because of, I suppose, a rise of fundamentalism, which we see, you know, around the world, I mean, all kinds of fundamentalism, country and Western, you get this kind of reduction of things to black and white. You know, people are divided into sort of opposing camps and then start throwing beer bottles at each other. Of course, you hear it in the media because the media love a fight. It doesn't really matter who's fighting who, what they're fighting about. But I think beneath the kind of, I don't know, the veneer of what the media do and so forth, most people do understand that 90% of life is grey. And where, you know, the human body is concerned and the, you know, the history of the nude in art is concerned, that this, it's probably a passing thing. Everything's a wave, as they say, you know.
100 years ago, of course, we were all scandalised by Norman Lindsay's nudes. Mm. These pneumatic, pouting, salacious ladies and with their leering pirates. So it's rather strange that one century later we've totally reversed our sources of anxiety vis-a-vis the nude. Mm. Now we could have as many pouting, pneumatic, salacious nudes as we like in popular culture, but we're terribly concerned about, you know, the adolescent.
You mentioned that you had overwhelming support from models for over 35 years. Do you mean that after that controversy people came forward to you and volunteered their support? The other question I wanted to ask was about sourcing models since then, whether parents have been affected by the controversy and whether invitations to schools have been as forthcoming as previously.
Well, to answer the first question, I'm still friends with people I photographed 35 years ago. I'm still friends with people that I photographed at the age of 12 who ring me up to complain about their adult children misbehaving. I still regard myself as being fortunate because the people that I am in contact with are all supportive. I mean, I spent quite a lot of time convincing them not to come forward and sort of weigh into the debate, because all that was going to do was get chopped up and used in the press for whatever. Obviously, the press did track down a few people and they were pretty strong in their support. But, you know, I'm prepared to accept that perhaps out there somewhere, at whatever point in the past, there could be someone who looks back on their involvement with me as a model and thinks to themselves, always felt a bit weird, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, the most you can really say about it, though, is that it was an error of judgment. You have to live, you know. What about all those kids that study ballet? You know, they sacrifice a huge part of their lives, and then at the age of puberty, suddenly nature decides she's got other plans for them. Do you regret having spent all that time standing at the bar and sweating blood? Do you regret the fact that you were riding a horse and fell off and, you know, injured yourself? And you know, this whole thing about living in a state of regret is a kind of sickness, I think. The second part of the question relating to the availability of models, I think really, well, I have been speaking at schools. I haven't stopped speaking at schools. But schools are concerned, of course, about the publicity. They're not concerned about, you know, you can pick up from art teachers that you speak to and they say, it's driving us crazy. We want to have you back. Principals worried about the publicity, you know. So there is a kind of a sense in which people are worried about being caught up in some crazy media sort of blitz again.
Do you feel the fear of censorship is having a dramatic influence on the progression of contemporary art? And I'm talking also about self-censorship.
Well, the reason that I made those kind of comments about, the political dimension at least of some of those comments was because I believe, as I said before, that there is a great pool of common sense and reasonableness, but sometimes that gets hijacked. You know, people who are otherwise quite clear and, you know, sharp in their opinions do get confused when notions of consent and harm come up. I mentioned it in passing there in my speech. But, you know, and I probably have to thank a few of my barrister mates for straightening these facts out for me, kids do consent to all kinds of significant things all the time in this state and in this country. A 10-year-old can consent to something that might otherwise be unlawful assault, dental work. In this state, a 15-year-old can consent to a sex change. There is a mountain of case law that shows that consent is something that gradually increases as kids move toward their majority. This is the reality of the law today. Now, of course, you can't speak about consent without speaking about harm. Now, I'm not talking about imagined harm, notional harm, perceived harm, actual harm to actual kids. I'd suggest that every day in this state and around the country, children consent and their parents consent and schools, both government and private, consent to activities that result in real harm to real kids all the time. Significant amounts of harm which are accurately documented and there for any of us who care to look them up. I'm talking about the harm that results from underage contact sport. Imagine being a happy, healthy 12-year-old boy kicking a football around 1 minute and then finding yourself in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. We can't imagine the psychological and emotional damage. You know, it's all very well, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, I hear from the back of the hall, and I agree. But where there is massive statistical information to show the real harm to real kids that results from that, it's significant. There's no specific documentation to suggest anywhere, so far as my legal researchers have been able to discover, that shows that life modelling by children for artists results in physical or psychological damage.
Bill Henson, speaking at The Edge in Federation Square in Melbourne earlier this month for the opening of the Melbourne Art Fair. Responses to this talk by Bill Henson have been just about as polarised as they were to the 2008 controversy. In The Age newspaper, Michael Coulter described it as artistic arrogance 101. In the online Art Life, Din Hegney called it inspiring and poetic. Well, what do you think? Email us via the Artworks website if you want to share your response. And if you want to hear and see the full lecture, it'll be on Big Ideas TV this Tuesday at 11 a.m. That's on ABC One. I'm Amanda Smith and this is Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.